This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
From San Diego, a leading center of telecommunications with 500 companies employing 39,000 people, the San Diego Telecom Council presents Telecom Today.
Good evening, and welcome to Telecom Today. I'm Barbara Bree.
And I'm Marco Thompson. Tonight, our focus is Wi-Fi, or wireless fidelity, an exciting technology that allows access to the Internet from your couch at home, a bed in a hotel room, or a coffee shop, all without wires, and it speeds faster than most cable modem connections. Wi-Fi is becoming popular all over the world in public locations, businesses, and homes.
Starbucks recently announced it has more than doubled the number of coffee houses with Wi-Fi access to 1,000 across the United States, including 193 here in San Diego, and it expects to add 800 more by the end of the year. Intel Corporation is investing $150 million in companies developing Wi-Fi, either helping to add more Wi-Fi-equipped locations or improve the Wi-Fi infrastructure. Seattle, Washington, Portland, Oregon, San Diego, and other cities in the United States have not-for-profit efforts aimed at developing free wireless broadband networks.
Tonight we explore how Wi-Fi works, how much it costs, who likes it and who doesn't, and how it's going to change the way we live and work. Plus, in our special five-minute segment, Barbara talks with Rick Valencia, a telecommunications entrepreneur who has been successful in raising venture capital in these difficult times.
So stay with us on Telecom Today. We're here tonight with three experts, all of whom are involved with a different aspect of Wi-Fi.
Our guests are David Hutchis, Associate Director of Engineering Computing at the Jacobs School of Engineering at the University of California, San Diego; Kathy Pucher, the Wireless Communications Sales Director for Texas Instruments in the Americas. Kathy is also the head of the San Diego Telecom Council's Wi-Fi Coalition; and Matt Westervelt, the founder of Seattle Wireless, a not-for-profit organization developing a wireless broadband network in Seattle.
Welcome, all of you. Thank you for joining us tonight. Kathy, I'd like to start with you. Tell us, what is Wi-Fi and why is there so much hype about it?
Well, Barbara, Wi-Fi is a wireless LAN technology.
What is LAN?
LAN is a local area network, but essentially what Wi-Fi enables is untethered, wireless, high-speed, high-bandwidth access to the Internet or Internet. The technology itself is actually governed by IEEE 802.11, and the most popular implementation of 802.11 or Wi-Fi today is 802.11b. 802.11b, and the data rates are very fast. We say high bandwidth and we mean it. It's theoretically 11 megabits per second. The reason that Wi-Fi is so hot and exciting is just the growth in the market. Between 2001 and 2002, the market has more than doubled, and by 2004, it's expected to double again.
So Matt, how does it work, and if I'm a consumer or an owner of a business and I want to install this equipment, what are the pieces of it that I need to make it work?
You would need a Wi-Fi card. It's essentially a PCMCIA or PCI card that fits in your computer, desktop, laptop. You would need an access point, generally. You can do card-to-card communications or you can do card-to-access point communications. The generally accepted way is, of course, to grab an access point, plug this into your local area network or DSL or cable modem. Then you would plug this other card in your desktop computer, your laptop computer, and it would be able to connect to that.
So, David, what is an access point? Is that a piece of equipment you need to buy?
Basically, it acts as a bridge between a wired Ethernet connection and a wireless Ethernet connection. That's essentially all it is. It includes a radio transmitter, radio receiver, that connects to the PCI or PCMCIA card that Matt mentioned. That's essentially all it is. It also allows you to aggregate a bunch of wireless end users into a single point and then bridge them onto a wired Ethernet.
David, we heard Kathy talk about 802.11. What is 802.11? Is it a spectrum? What does it mean?
Well, the IEEE, which is the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers, is a professional society that basically writes, among other things, writes standards. And it's, you can think of it kind of as the Dewey Decimal System. So they have 802, the 802 spec, which refers to LAN technologies, local area network technologies. And you have 802.11, which is 802.11, which refers to wireless technologies. And then there are a variety of specs inside 802.11 that refer to a variety of things such as maximum bandwidth, the frequency that they operate on, the encoding scheme that they use for transmitting packets back and forth, that sort of thing. It's just a specification, basically, so that everybody plays by the same rules.
Right. So, Kathy, what are some of the trends in the industry in your position in the semiconductor business? I'm sure you have some feelings about the statistics of the growth and the projections for the future. Where do you see the numbers game in the Wi-Fi business in the next couple of years?
Short answer, headed in the right direction, very exciting, up and to the left. Up and to the right, excuse me. So some of the exciting areas, let's take, for instance, PDA. Today, there's several products on the market that are just beginning to come out that have 802.11 built inside the PDA. Within 2 years, you'll see probably 50% of PDAs having Wi-Fi built inside, being Wi-Fi ready.
I believe you've got one of those products here with you, don't you?
Indeed.
You have a prop you could bring out.
I can bring out the prop. Basically, this is actually an older model, in which case the 802.11 card is not integrated into it. But as Kathy mentioned, these days, not just PDAs, but laptops also are coming with Wi-Fi built in. And that's going to become the common thing. It's just wirelessly enabled. It works quite well. You can check email, browse the internet, all sorts of that, sorts of
so,
things.
So,
like that.
In a numbers game, yeah. where are the numbers going?
So, in a numbers game, so from a notebook, within 1 to 2 years, notebooks will have probably 100% of all notebooks that are sold will have Wi-Fi inside. So, the attach rate is huge. I think PCs are roughly, I think it's somewhere between 50-80 million units sold. So, that's a huge number of Wi-Fi products that'll be on the market. PDAs are approximately, in the next couple of years, 40 to 50 million units. If you get 50% attached, that's 25, 30 million units of Wi-Fi ports out there. Another really, really exciting area, though, is actually the smartphone. So the TAM today for phones in general is 400 to 500 million, expected to continue to grow in the future. Today, there's several key phone manufacturers that have active programs that include Wi-Fi with a phone, and the phone is actually a smartphone, so it does some data. And what we're seeing is the potential is huge if Wi-Fi goes into the phone market, where the, let's say, 10% of the phone market, which is 400 to 500 million units, becomes Wi-Fi enabled. That's another 40 to 50 million units that's added to the Wi-Fi market. I mean, just huge potential.
Well, David, you have a technical background. You're at UCSD. If all of these people have all of these Wi-Fi-enabled devices, is there enough spectrum available for everybody to be able to communicate using Wi-Fi?
It's actually one of the interesting research activities that's going on campus is that to see what happens when you have high-density access point placement, a lot of access points in a room or a collection of rooms, and high densities of users. What does that do to the network bandwidth? Does it really adversely affect your performance? I think that it's an interesting game where you build a certain setup for wireless access points and end users and so on. You see how it does really well, then more people use it, and then you have to kind of change the way the layout is and so on. But I don't think it's really going to be a horrible problem because I believe the technology will keep up with the ability for people to utilize the wireless network. For example, there's a research activity just starting now in the computer science department and in Cal IT Squared, which deals with the very topic of very high density and very high bandwidth wireless connectivity.
A classroom with 300 participating students. Exactly
right. And that's one of the things that happens here on campus is that it's very useful when you have a large number of people wirelessly enabled in an environment that's pretty close to being ubiquitous from the perspective of where people typically hang out. You can treat them as guinea pigs, essentially, and you can watch what the behavior looks like in terms of the network performance and things like that. But in general, I think that it will probably be okay. You will have glitches as you go along, as you do with any kind of technology, but I think we'll be able to keep up with that kind of thing.
So, Matt, we've heard a little bit about the campus experience, and one of the things people do with Wi-Fi today is they cover homes, businesses, and campus with it. You're building something very different and unique and trying to cover Seattle with a wireless network, which is a free network for all of its users. Tell us about why you're doing that, and tell us about some of the lessons learned in that process.
Well, the why is pretty simple, and the reason that we're doing it is because we can. What we're doing is actually a little bit more complicated. Rather than putting access points on the end of an internet connection, say, like in a campus network or, you know, like at Starbucks or something like that, what we're actually doing is creating a wireless backhaul from, home A to home B, so home A can connect to home C. This involves both creating, a wireless access point that the user in home A can connect to, but also this wireless backhaul. Also, there is routing information that needs to be transferred so we can know when home D connects to home C or to home B.
Or business A.
Business A. We're modeling our network a lot after the internet, actually, and we're using standards and, standards-based protocols. So we're using multi-vendor equipment. We're not tied to anyone like Cisco or Lucent or D-Link or Linksys or any of those other manufacturers, TI. But it's kind of an interesting prospect because we're taking the network that somebody would generally bring to you and we're building it ourselves as users of that network. So it's a bit of a change in how you would build a telecommunications network.
So would this allow me, if I were a business user and I had two separate campuses, instead of trying to buy telecommunication services from a carrier and running my network through the twisted pair copper that lives in the streets, I could use your network to connect my two buildings that were a mile away, for instance?
Yes, provided that you also allowed other people to connect to those two buildings.
It's kind of like the free software movement where you can have it for free as long as whatever you do to it you give back to the environment.
Basically, our only rule is that local transit is free. And this provides us with a backbone that we wouldn't have if we were building disparate links.
Are the telephone companies upset about what you're doing? Do they feel this deprives them of revenue?
I'm not a telephone company. I'm not really sure what their take on it is. I've received no nasty letters or anything like that. The telephone companies have, looked at this and they see us as, another technology group doing something interesting with technology as far as I can tell.
What makes things challenging is Wi-Fi as a business model is still being proved out. I mean, I think everybody acknowledges that there's definitely a business model, but validating that business model is still in play. And in parallel, you have activities like Matt has described or free hotspots. And at one level, it appears threatening that the two models are going in play at the same time. But my perspective is they're both going to coexist. There's going to be an opportunity for free networks, free internet access via Wi-Fi, and then they'll also be a very, very valuable business model. I mean, for instance, I could just give an example. I got stuck at the airport the other day because of fog. We were joking about fog in San Diego. It shut it down for quite a long time. And I went into the Admirals Club and spent on the spot $450, didn't even think twice. And the whole reason I did that was because they had Wi-Fi access in the Admirals Club, and I knew I could be much more efficient in getting work done while I was stuck at the airport, a more and more common, you know, experience. So there's definitely a business model.
So, Kathy, to explain the difference, there's free access like Matt's group is setting up in Seattle, but then you can pay for access. Starbucks, for example, aren't they charging people to have Wi-Fi access in their coffee shops?
Sure, and it isn't actually Starbucks that charges, but in this case, in the case of Starbucks, it's T-Mobile. And T-Mobile is a service provider, much like AT&T for your home or AT&T wireless for your cell phone. And T-Mobile provides a service. There's an all-you-can-eat plan where you pay, you know, $20 for 120 minutes. I'm a user of that. Just bumped up to $50 today. Or you can get a value meal where you have, you know, $49.99 unlimited throughout the nation. Don't quote me on those figures.
I understand. I'm sure the numbers change daily as the marketplace changes.
Sure. And I can speak as a user, it's incredibly easy to get your account set up, set your password up with T-Mobile, choose your value meal, and get going within minutes.
So Kathy, tell us what's going on in San Diego on the free side of Wi-Fi, and specifically what your group in the Telecom Council is up to.
Sure. So our group is the Wi-Fi Coalition, and our goal was to unite the different interests in Wi-Fi, form a Wi-Fi community in San Diego. UCSD is a very important part of that effort. And one of the things that we wanted to do, the first initiative of what we hope to be a larger scale of initiatives, was to set up a free hotspot. And we picked a particular location in the Sorrento Mesa area where we know that there's a lot of people that will benefit and have the end equipments that will be able to use the Wi-Fi network. And the idea was just to give people the opportunity to use it on the go. And get addicted and bring the technology, bring Wi-Fi back to their homes, back to their offices, and use it as in their business travels, et cetera.
So where is this free access point?
It's at the Sorrento Mesa Food Court, Scranton Road, and Morehouse.
And Mira Mesa Boulevard.
In the Mira Mesa, yes.
David, what is UCSD doing with Wi-Fi on the campus?
Well, there are two ways in which we use it in this sort of, in some sense, boring way. It's part of our production network now. There's the expectation that there are places, public areas on campus, where you have access to wireless now. The advantage of wireless, obviously, is that you can extend network access to places where you didn't normally have it before. So this includes things like all of the public eating areas, the cafeterias, some of the dorms, public areas inside and outside, indoors and outdoors. A lot of the high traffic areas either have wireless access now or will soon have wireless access. Most of the major large classrooms have wireless access. So in the sort of mundane sense, it's part of our production network. We have now over 300 access points installed on campus. We have a measured user base of over 4,000 registered users. On the other side is the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that we have pretty good wireless access coverage on campus and that we have a large population of people who grew up with things like PDAs, for example, or laptops, we have a very interesting testbed from a research perspective to see what happens when you have a large population, a large percentage of which is wirelessly enabled. So, for example, there are a couple of projects on campus right now, one of which wirelessly equipped all of the incoming computer science freshmen with, or not IPACs, but Jornadas, which are essentially similar to this. And another project, all of the incoming freshmen for one of the new colleges on campus, Sixth College, were all equipped. Every single one of them was equipped with a Jornada, all, again, wirelessly enabled. And so from a research perspective, obviously there's the technical side of it, and seeing what happens when you put all these people on a network and that sort of thing. But there's a very interesting sociological side of this that if you think about it, these are the people who grew up with these kinds of devices or are growing up with these kinds of devices. And it's interesting to watch how things change when they use these devices.
David, isn't there also a cyber shuttle that goes around the campus?
Yes, there is. Along the lines of extending wireless to places where we didn't have wireless before, we have, through a partnership with Qualcomm, put in place essentially a high-speed cellular modem that acts as the backhaul for an 802.11b wireless connection inside some of the shuttles on campus. There's one that goes to the Coaster Station. We have one running on the campus loop. There's another one that goes to University City. And essentially what it does is it allows a mobile 802.11 bubble that follows you around on the bus. The advantage of this is the fact that you have users who are used to using their laptops in the wireless areas on campus, and now you have them kind of transparently being able to use these things on a shuttle.
And so if I'm sitting next to the shuttle in traffic, I can check my email.
Absolutely.
Because that bubble is bigger than just the shuttle itself.
In fact, I sometimes will instant message with people who are taking the shuttle over to the Coaster Station saying, how's it going, what's the traffic light, stuff like that.
Very interesting. What are the security issues that you're having at UCSD?
Well, there are two senses in which security is important from a wireless perspective. One is encryption. Anybody can sniff the packets that are going by on the air, and you have to ensure that those packets are encrypted in some fashion so that even though they can look at the packets, they can't read what's in them.
Are you having a problem with security
No.
on campus?
No,
is anybody abusing it?
We haven't really seen much abuse yet. It's entirely possible that people are sniffing our packets. We know that people do, but what can you do?
Great. Well, we have one last question, and then we'll wrap up. And I'd like to address it to each one of you in turn, starting with David. What do you think will be the next big breakthrough in Wi-Fi, either the technology or the marketplace?
Well, we'll continue to see improvements in bandwidth and reliability and range. I think the thing that will be really interesting is watching the applications that are developed specifically for these small devices and mobility and internet connection. I think that's the thing that's going to be really interesting when people start developing applications specifically for this market.
How people's behavior change
exactly.
when they have this type of technology.
Exactly.
Kathy?
Marco, that one's easy for me. Voice. Voice is always been the killer app when it comes to the mobile market. And what I see as explosive growth is voice over the wireless LAN and the technology being integrated into a cell phone. And that'll also bring technology breakthroughs because we'll need to address the cost and power to go enable those kinds of volumes.
Very interesting. Matt?
I actually agree with Kathy. Well, there are 802.11b smartphones on the way, but from what I've gathered, they're not that smart. They're not doing voice over 802.11b. They're still using the carrier network and using 802.11b strictly as a data channel. The second that those can do voice over 802.11b is, I think, the big breakthrough.
Very interesting. Well, I'd like to thank David, Kathy, and Matt for their insights. Next, Barbara goes one-on-one with Rick Valencia, CEO of ProfitLine, which recently raised $12 million in venture capital.
Rick, what does ProfitLine do?
ProfitLine is a business process outsourcer, and what we do is that we handle the administrative functions within a telecommunications department to enable our clients to focus on technology. Our clients tend to be big companies that have very big voice and data networks, and they, within their IT and telecom departments, they've got technical professionals who tend to get tasked also with the administrative functions. So what we do is we go in and relieve them of the burden of the processing of billing, of the ordering of services, of the managing of their contracts, and let them outsource the things that aren't necessarily core to their business or even to their own skill set to us. And we've developed a technology that we use to enable us to do a much better job than most companies can do internally. And by virtue of the audit that we provide through that whole process, we save our clients typically four or five times what they pay us to do the work.
When did you start the company?
It was 1992.
What are your revenues and are you profitable?
We're a profitable company. Our revenues will be a little bit over $7 million this year.
Okay. And I understand that last summer you started out to raise venture capital. Why?
Well, it was an interesting process. We really didn't set out ourselves to raise capital. We started getting inbound calls from investors who were interested in the business process outsourcing space in general and had heard about ProfitLine through our Inc. 500 listing. And we were getting calls literally every week from different investors that we were turning away until about the middle of the summer when I realized that, boy, we had something really neat going on here, a great opportunity in a difficult market, getting the types of calls that we were getting that maybe we should look a little bit more seriously to take advantage of this. And there's no clear leader in our space in terms of market size. We consider ourselves one of the leaders for sure, but we really felt this was an opportunity to bring in the capital needed to really separate ourselves from the crowd.
How had you been funded up until that point?
Well, we were a bootstrapped company. Of course, in the early days when it was just me, it was credit cards or whatever else I could cobble together to keep the business going. But we built the business one client at a time and with the revenue that we generated from each of those clients up until June of this year.
Rick, how much money did you end up raising?
We raised $12 million.
Why do you think you were successful in a market where a lot of entrepreneurs are having such a hard time?
Well, we had been in business for 10 years. We had a proven product that we were already selling into Fortune 1000 clients. We had a profitable business, which is, I think, real key right now. And the investors were had very much changed their mentality from the quick, big hits of the dot-com days. And frankly, during those days, I felt like I was missing something. I felt miserable. I'm working away, killing myself at this business, and I see these people making millions of dollars overnight, and I was wondering what I was doing wrong, but fell into, a couple of years later, what turned out to be a sweet spot for investors, which is profitable companies selling into to big companies, Fortune 1000 companies, and growing. We were growing very fast.
Rick, what advice would you give to an entrepreneur who is setting out to raise money today?
Well, what really made a difference for me was about a year ago, I decided to seek help. And I got guidance from a number of different sources. It started off with the Chairman's Roundtable and then the San Diego Telecom Council, accepting mentorship opportunities, accepting presentation opportunities before the MIT Forum. All of that really gave me the opportunity to get word out what we were doing here and to get people excited about what we were doing. And those people really helped us see the opportunity. They didn't tell us that we needed to do anything different and therefore we were successful in raising money. They told us about the opportunity that was out there that I didn't see myself because I was too busy working day in and day out just getting the job done. So getting that help, just sort of looking up and saying, I'm here and I'm willing to accept the guidance and accept the help, made all the difference in the world.
Well, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Now, there's a service every CFO could love. ProfitLine certainly doing a great job in these tough times. That wraps it up for this edition of Telecom Today. I'm Marco Thompson.
And I'm Barbara Bree. Thank you and good night.